covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Hey everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
The T-ball program, usually heard at this time, will be momentarily delayed for a special broadcast.
Prepare yourself for a trip through time, space, and the reality that you have known. When you enter into Willow's world. Willow Andreasen brings you the thought-provoking dialogue and news from around the world that shows your mind has no limitations. Take it away, Willow.
Good afternoon and welcome from a beautiful United Kingdom. My name is Willow Andreasen, also known as Sari Sunflower, in the Revolution Radio at freedomslips.org chat room. And this is the Monday, the 27th of March, 2023 edition of Willow's World. And before I get started with telling you what's happening on today's show, I just want to say a big, big thank you to Dr. Jim Fetzer, who's just been on over the other side of the studio wall with today's The Raw Deal. A big, big thank you indeed to Jim. And also a big, big thank you to all the hosts here at the station for everything you all do. It's truly appreciated indeed. A big, big thank you. Also, huge outpourings of gratitude as well, and lots of love and hugs to the producers and moderators who sometimes have a few challenges to handle, but they do so promptly and with smiles on their faces. A big, big thank you to them. Also, huge outpourings of gratitude as well, and lots of love and hugs to the team. I'm humbled and honoured to be a part of a team that bends over backwards and just that little bit more to ensure that this station remains on air for as close to 24/7 as we can get it, which is most of the time. Huge outpourings of gratitude as well, and lots of love and hugs and kisses to Liz Ringley, who continues to represent so, so much to this station, and to the hugest of hugest outpourings of gratitude to the individual whose prescience, whose vision, whose drive convinced him it was necessary to construct this vehicle for free speech, which took its maiden journey on New Year's Day 2011. And it was his intention that, because of course he could see these times coming, as could many of us, but it was his intention very much so that folks should be able to navigate these particularly challenging waters that we are currently navigating as fearlessly and as self-sufficiently as possible. And in the 12 years that the station has been on air, it's become a global family of like-minded souls of kindred spirits who have gravitated towards each other and indeed been reunited with each other in certain cases as a result of Mike Ringley's amazing gift. And we miss him every single day. A big, big thank you to Hawk for this amazing gift of a station. Thank you very much indeed. Also, huge outpourings of gratitude as well, and lots of love and hugs to my late other half, Briareos, for everything that he continues to represent in my life and always, always will. Thank you very, very much indeed, my love. And also huge outpourings of gratitude as well, and lots of love and hugs to some very, very special loved ones indeed. They know exactly who they are. They know exactly who they are. A big, big thank you to them. And to the musician as well. Yeah, I think game is on now, definitely. I've got no doubt about it. No doubt about it whatsoever. And last but not least, folks, huge outpourings of gratitude to you amazing listeners. We do this for you. We wouldn't be able to do this without you either, folks. Totally symbiotic relationship. It's your kindness, your love, your support, your generosity that enables us to continue providing you with such a wide variety of shows hosted by fantastic individuals from all around the world on a close to 24/7 basis. It's that very same kindness, love, generosity and support that enables us to do so on a commercial free basis. Yep, you will hear promos here, but those promo slots are restricted. Every single one I've heard is restricted to station business only, station shows, station info. There are certain hosts who will promote their own wares, which they're entitled to do on their shows, but those promo slots are generally restricted from everyone I've heard to station business itself. And also it's your kindness, support and generosity that enables us to continue providing you with the archives for free, which, as I say, we anticipate or hope will remain the case in the future. But again, a big, big thank you, though, to all of you who support us. I mean, we know just how challenging these times are right now. So many, and I know I say this at the start of every single show, and do you know what? I've had people saying, you know, accusing me of being glib about it. You're being glib. It's not sincere. Oh, it's sincere, all right. It comes from the heart. And we know just how challenging these times are for so many right now, and we appreciate all your support. We are humbled and honoured indeed that you are continuing to support us through these times. And I hope that you can feel the gratitude enveloping you as I speak, not just today, but every single day from everyone here at the station. A big, big thank you to you all for your continued support. Thank you. Now, as I mentioned, we are entirely listener-supported, folks. If you'd like to help us out and you're not sure how, what I recommend you do is you visit our website, which you can reach using one of two URLs. It's either www.revolution.radio, that's www.revolution.radio, or www.freedomslips.com. www.freedomslips.org, sorry. www.freedomslips.org, org, or net, either or. And you can... You'll arrive upon this amazing website of ours, which has been established and lovingly maintained by the amazing Monster 383. So when you see him in the chat room, folks, say a big, big thank you to him. He's done a sterling job indeed. A big, big thank you to him, and say a big, big thanks to my fellow managers, folks. I don't want any. I just do what I do and hope it works. Places you need to explore to be found on the nav bar, that is the static bar of options, remains there sedentary at the top of the homepage. You click on donations, which is 6 for long. That opens up in a new tab for you, details all the methods of supporting the station, bar 1. We've got Patreon, we've got Donor Box, we've got direct payment North America only. So that's all have monthly support options available with them. And you need to be a patron in order to do so on Patreon. By the way, you can become a patron either by clicking on this option here on the donations page, or returning to the homepage where you'll find it sitting pretty in pink if you've got a light background, or in green if you've got a dark background like me near the top of the page. Donor Box is the alternative to PayPal. It's international in scope. It's easy to use. Again, you can set up something for regular monthly support, or you can use it whenever you are able to use it. Direct payment North America only applies if you happen to live in the US or Canada and have a credit or debit card. Same options available there as with DonorBox. We accept three different types of cryptocurrency as well, folks. They are Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash. I'll repeat those. Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash. There are QR codes on the screen. You point your devices at them and you do your thing. And last but not least, the snail mail details, folks. Yep, we still accept checks or money orders, and they are to be made payable to Revolution Radio. That's two separate words. Revolution spelled R-E-V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N. I'll repeat that. R-E-V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N. And radio is spelled R-A-D-I-O. I'll repeat that. R-A-D-I-O. And then they are to be mailed to the wonderful lady horse, Terry Ackerman. Terry spelled T-E-R-R-Y. I'll repeat that. T-E-R-R-Y. And Ackerman is spelled A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. I'll repeat that as well. It's A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. And the mailing address is 1793. That's 1793 North Eden. Eden spelled E-D-O-N Road. And that's Allen, A-L-L-E-N, Michigan, M-I, 49227. So checks or money orders made payable to Revolution Radio are then to be mailed to the wonderful lady horse, Terry Ackerman, at 1793 North Eden Road. And that's Allen, Michigan, 49227. Those details can also be found on the main homepage as well. I'm returning there right now. If you'd like to advertise on the station's website, folks, if you've got a product or company you'd like to get out there, but cost is a bit of an issue right now, but you want it to be seen by plenty of people, which it would be here, you can advertise on the station's website. And for further details, you need to contact the GM himself, A Mad Painter, using the following email address, which is themadpainter13@yahoo.com. That's themadpainter13@yahoo.com. I'll spell out that first segment for you. It's themadpainter13. And I'll repeat that. It's themadpainter13. TER13@yahoo.com, or lowercase in format, by the way. We've got dedicated call to listen numbers for both studios A and B, folks. The numbers, you just call, you just listen, as it says on the site. You don't have to participate, you don't have to speak, but we do heartily recommend that you speak to your cell phone or landline service providers. There are costs involved with calling those numbers. Please call them first. Check that out first. Once you're happy with what you've been told, the dedicated call to listen number for studio A is 641-793-6370. So for Studio A, it's 641-793-6370. And the dedicated call to listen number for Studio B is 641-793-2531. I'll repeat that. Studio B is 641-793-2531. But please check with your providers first before calling those numbers, okay? And last but not least, the archives, they're free to access, will be for the foreseeable. You can reach the archives either by clicking third along on the nav bar on the archives option or going direct to its URL, which is www.revolutionradioarchives.com. That's www.revolutionradioarchives.com. And the details you need to access the wonders that await you within are the username and the password, both of which are lowercase and case sensitive in format. The username is Rev Radio. That's Rev Radio. I'll spell that for you. It's R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O. And I'll repeat that for you. It's R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O. And the password is ROCKS exclamation mark. That's ROCKS exclamation mark. I'll spell that for you. It's R-O-C-K-S exclamation mark. And I'll repeat that for you. It's R-O-C-K-S exclamation mark. Don't forget that exclamation mark, folks, because without it, you won't be able to get in. I know that because I omitted it. And guess what happened? Nothing, because I omitted it. So remember it, you'll be fine. But again, a big, big thank you to everyone for your continued support. We are truly, truly grateful indeed. Thank you. So what's happening on today's show? Well, I'm going to wander into the chat room shortly to say a big hello to everybody in there. Make sure everybody is okay. And then we're going to be commencing the first hour with the geek headlines. Courtesy of the Nexus of Nerdom, this is Io9 Gizmodo's Morning Spoilers, followed by the Gallivant Through Geekery, that is the Monday Afternoon Geek Out. Got three articles today. First is from Kotaku, heading into the world of gaming to learn about the leaking of details believed to be connected to LEGO's upcoming video racing game. From Gizmodo, we're taking a trip in the TARDIS and temporarily traversing into the Hooniverse to find out more about the 60th anniversary transmedia project Doomsday. Boy, have I seen some griping and whining on... Oh, I'll get to that in a minute. I mean, I'm a lurker on various Who forums, and my word. I mean, some of the conduct in there makes me embarrassed to admit I'm a Who fan at times. I just think, you shut up. I mean, the whining is just... Ugh. Anyway, carrying on. Finally, from the Den of Geek, we're returning to the world of gaming and journeying into the gaming past to discover why Square Enix didn't release the real second, third, and fifth installments of the Final Fantasy franchise outside of Japan. Second hour is commencing with the first of a new selection of poetry focusing on the topic of the good old days in Willow's pep talk segment, which of course is going to be renamed at the top of at the beginning of April, because yeah, it's always been a temporary name anyway, and I've finally found one I'm happy with. After which the doors are open to the cozy nook that is the poetry corner. Now we're returning to the world of 8th century Chinese poetry for a study of one of its most powerful of literary leviathans. Born in the year 701 into a successful merchant family believed to have descended from the Li dynastic royal family of the Tang dynasty, he was raised in the region now known as Chengdu in the Sichuan province of China. He was a voracious reader of Confucian classics, along with astrological and metaphysical works, and was composing poetry by the age of 10. During adolescence, he became a skilled fencer and assisted the poor and oppressed financially and otherwise. As an adult, he was married 4 times, was widely travelled, and was involved in the politics of the regions in which he lived. He was friends with fellow literary leviathan Dufu, who he had met in 744, and both were prominent figures in what is believed to be the golden age of Chinese poetry. I've already covered, Dufu, of course, has already been a study here in the Poetry Corner. Trouble was stirring, however, and peace soon came to an end with the An Lushan Rebellion of 755. The poet was acting as advisor to Emperor Xuanzong's son, Prince Yong, who was one of the leaders following Yan Zhong's abdication in 756. However, the prince was defeated by his brother in 757, and the poet, following a dramatic escape attempt, was imprisoned and initially sentenced to death. Negotiations from powerful friends led to the sentence being commuted to the poet being exiled to Guizhou, although he was pardoned during his journey to the region in 759. The political and royal chaos continued unabated, and the poet continued working on his poetic output. He died in the year 762, at the age of 61. Recognised as a highly technical and masterful poet, and globally influential in scope, composer Gustav Mahler and Beat Generation poet Gary Snyder were inspired by his works. His notable works include one of his most famous poems, Quiet Night Thought. He was born in what is now known as the Chui region, Kyrgyzstan, and his name was Li Bai. The remainder of the show sees us exploring the spookier side of life in spectral matters. The first article sees us heading north of the border into Scotland to study the mythological beings known as the Kelpies. The second article remains within Caledonia to explore the history connected with one of the most famous of aquatic mythological, the Loch Ness Monster. We're concluding today's spectral journey with a journey west of the border with an examination of the legend of Nessie's Welsh cousin, the Afanc of the River Conwy. So, got a lot to get on with today, folks. Heading into the chat room to say a big hello in there. I apologise for any Welsh pronunciations there. It's probably not very good, is it? Anyway, heading into the chat room. Let's see who is in. Wonderful manager that is Mr. Rowe is in the chat room. Of course, he is the host of 3 shows. He is on Sundays, or this studio rather. He's on Sundays at 5 p.m. Eastern with the Rowe Lounge, 2 4 p.m. offerings. Today's is Crypto Corner. Tomorrow's is Rowe's Corner. He's on Studio B as well on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern with Reality Extraction. Produces a number of shows as well. Wonderful. Another wonderful manager is in as well, the lovely Lady Horse. Lady Horse, of course, is the host of A Touch of Country, which is on this studio on Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern. She's also the station's treasurer and moderator manager, an all round lovely person. Another fabulous manager is in. That's Pat Rabbit. Patrick, of course, is the host of Not for Public Consumption, which is on Studio B on Thursdays at midday Eastern. Another fabulous host is in, The Mechanic. The Mechanic, of course, hosts three shows here on Studio A. He was on earlier this morning at 2 a.m. Eastern with an open round table. He sees in Thursday mornings here on A at midnight Eastern by chairing the High Council round table. And he's also on, when he can make it, on Thursdays as well, on Studio A at 4 p.m. Eastern with The Common Denominator. Mace 139 is in, as well as Mona. Mona, of course, is over the other side of the studio wall at the moment with today's Adventures of a Feral Hippie. Malaya is in as well. I'm going up to the top of the hour. Jonathan Wright, one of our fabulous hosts, is in, who with Crypt Rick is the host of the Crypt Rick and Jonathan show, which is on Studio B on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Let's go up to the top of the hour. Yeah, I've covered everyone, I think. I've covered everyone. I'm just making sure. Yeah, I have done. But if you want to come in and join us, folks, please do. Be good to see you in the chat room. The more, the merrier. It'll be good to see you. So we're going to start geeking out. So we're heading over to the Nexus of Nerdom. This is IO9 Gizmodo for the day's geek headlines, which, of course, is their morning spoiler section. Compiled today by Gordon Jackson and Linda Cadega. It was posted up 4 hours ago. And its headline, Nick Cage's campy Dracula stalks new prey in Renfield. We've got more news from the Walking Dead universe, some Ghostbusters casting, and more Riverdale madness. Riverdale's still going. Good grief. So there really is so much good SFF happening right now. It's kind of wild. Renfield is looking to be a campy Raimi-esque comedy gore fest. The power reflects modern inequities through a sci-fi reversal, and, oh, well, I guess Joker 2 is still happening. But the animated Gamera miniseries? That looks incredible. Time to get ready for the movie. Spoilers! So we start with Ghostbusters Firehouse. So Deadline reports Emily Allen Lind has joined the cast of the untitled sequel to Ghostbusters Afterlife, currently codenamed Firehouse, in an undisclosed role. John Wick is next, so Keanu Reeves and Lionsgate Group Chair Joe Drake both want there to be more John Wick films in the future. Reeves is going to be in the Ana de Armas spin-off The Ballerina and is open to doing more films. The Toxic Avenger is next, so during a recent interview with Film, sound editor Casey Genton, revealed the upcoming Toxic Avenger remake starring Peter Dinklage, Kevin Bacon, Elijah Wood and Jacob Tremblay contains a gory moment referred to as the butt-guts scene by members of the crew. Here's a quote. So it's a really funny movie. Macon Blair, the director, I think, did a really good job with it. Everybody was a dream on the film. I'm so surprised. For me, personally, I had not seen the original Toxic Avenger until I had done this film. And it's a huge cult classic, and I know people are really excited about it. But they have tested it. Fans of the film have been over the moon with the film. It's pretty out there. I think it's a different crack. They're giving the fans what they want, for sure. There's no lack of, I know everybody references the little kid's head getting run over and stuff. I think that there was an iteration of the film that didn't have enough of that, so they made a very, I don't want to ruin it. But it's been nicknamed the butt gut scene. And it's probably the best way to match that head-getting-run-over energy that everybody's looking for. So it's in line with the fan base, and I think it's hilarious. To each their own. Renfield is next to Bloody Disgusting. Also has several new photos of Nicholas Holt, Nicholas Cage, Ben Schwartz and Shohreh Aghdashloo in Renfield. And yes, there are images available if you want to spoil yourself, but if you don't look at this article. Ape vs. Mecha Ape is next. So after the United States tests an experimental giant mechanical ape on an unspecified Eastern European country, said country captures and reprograms the weapon to attack Chicago in the trailer for Ape vs. Mecha Ape. Where do they keep getting these ideas from? Seriously. Anyway, carrying on. The old man movie Lactopolypse is next. A dairy farmer has 24 hours to recapture and milk his escaped cow before she explodes in the trailer for the old man movie Lactopolypse, a stop motion feature from Estonia opening June the 2nd in the UK. All right. It's, Monday's going to be like this, is it? Okay. Superman and Lois is next. So Lois needs space. I've actually been reading about the developments in Superman and Lois. It's actually quite moving. So Lois needs space, and the synopsis for Head On, the April 11th episode of Superman and Lois, directed by Arrow's David Ramsey. So here's a synopsis. Clark, played by Tyler Hoechlin, and General Lane, played by Dylan Walsh, are both having a hard time giving Lois, played by Elizabeth Tulloch, room to make her own decisions. Meanwhile, Lana, played by Emmanuel Chikri, and Sarah, played by Indy Navarrete, have a run-in with an old friend at the diner. Lastly, Natalie, played by Taylor Buck, has a surprise visitor. David Ramsey directed the episode, written by Andrew N. Wong. The Walking Dead Dead City is next, so the new spin-off has a summer release date and a new trailer. The Walking Dead Dead City will premiere June 18th on AMC and AMC+. Gotham Knights is next, so our heroes prepare for a luncheon with their parents in the synopsis for More Money, More Problems. The April 11th episode of Gotham Knights. So here is the synopsis. So a plan to take down the Court of Owls leads Turner, played by Oscar Morgan, and the team to a notorious mobster family, the McKillens. Meanwhile, Carrie, played by Navia Robinson, and Stephanie, played by Anna Law, prepare for Gotham Academy's parents' luncheon. And Harvey, played by Misha Collins, seeks help from a psychiatrist. Olivia Rose Keegan, Fallon Smythe, and Tyler DiChiara also star. Namisha Mukherjee directed the episode, written by L. Lipson and Summer Plair. So Riverdale is next. Veronica organises a make-out party after a recent sex ed class leaves the Archie gang more confused than ever in sex education. The April 12th episode of Riverdale. So here is the synopsis. So after a lesson in sex education leaves a gang more confused than ever, Veronica, played by Camila Mendes, decides to organise a make-out party at the Pembroke. Elsewhere, Jughead, played by Cole Sprouse, attempts to help Ethel, played by guest star Shannon Purser, out of some trouble, only to find himself in hot water as well. So KJ Aper, Lily Reinhart, Madeline Petch, Madchen Amick, Casey Cott, Vanessa Morgan, and Drew Ray Tanner also star. James DeWitt directed the episode, written by Janine Salinas Schoenberg. Ghost is next. Very busy today because it's Monday. Meanwhile, Alberta and Isaac team up to solve the mystery of what happened to Crash's head in the synopsis for Ghost Father of the Bride, the April 13th episode of Ghosts. So after learning that Pete's daughter, Laura, played by Holly Gautier Frankel, is getting married, Sam, at Pete's behest, tries to convince her to hold her wedding at Woodstone B&B. Also, Alberta and Isaac team up to solve the mystery of what happened to Crash, played by Alex Boniello's head, on the CBS original series Ghosts. It's going to be on April 13th. And Caroline Aaron returns as Carol, Pete's wife. And it was written by Julia Harter and Liz Alexander and directed by Jay Karras. Yellow Jackets is next. So the survivors, both past and present, experience varying levels of psychosis in the trailer for Edible Complex, next week's episode of Yellow Jackets. And finally is Gamera Rebirth. Gamera challenges Jaeger to a rematch in the trailer for his new animated miniseries on Netflix. So yeah, busy day today. Generally, Monday tends to be. So I'm just going to post that in the chat room. I think I've got time for some Kotaku. Yeah, why not? Let's have a look at Kotaku, shall we? Look at the headlines on Kotaku. I was looking at it earlier on. PC gamer accused of asset theft removed from Steam. FaZe Clan stock price too embarrassing for Wall Street. Zelda fans can finally chill. Tears of the Kingdom deep dive is on the way. Terra Nil, the Kotaku review, is here. Looks very beautiful. I was watching some bits and pieces about Terra Nil at the weekend. Fantasy author Brandon Sanderson asks fans to calm down after getting slammed. I think I mentioned that yesterday. The Super Mario Brothers versus Lush Bath Bombs look like pee. Is it supposed to be versus? I have no idea. Anyway, gritty new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game takes after God of War. Netflix star wants to name kids after Elden Ring bosses and the internet approves. Resident Evil 4 remake's first fight can be skipped in a cool way. It's never been easier to find a shiny Pokemon for better or worse. And after 3 months of struggles, Ashika Island saved Warzone 2. If I've got time for any of these, I'll go back to them. There's quite a few there that made me go, what's that about? Did I read out the Brandon Sanderson one? No, I haven't, have I? No, I read it. That's what it was. There's a couple there that I'm interested in, but I will return to if time allows. So, we're going to get started with the articles that have already been selected for today. And the first one, we're remaining with Kotaku for this one, heading into the world of gaming. And, yeah, authored by Zach Sweezen, posted up on March the 20th, so a week ago. And it's headlined, New LEGO Racing Game Appears in Leaked Screenshots. So leaked screenshots and reports claim the game is titled LEGO 2K Drive. I do wish people wouldn't do this kind of thing, but I really do. I mean, I can appreciate why people are so excited about them, but I do wish they wouldn't do it, because it kind of ruins it for other people, doesn't it? So anyway, more details and reputed screenshots from LEGO 2K Drive, a yet-to-be-announced LEGO racing game from 2K, have leaked online. This aligns with past reports that 2K was working on a series of LEGO games. Over the last 20 years, we've seen a seemingly endless deluge of LEGO-related video games. From licensed action games like LEGO Star Wars to MMOs, open world adventures and mobile titles. But since then, LEGO gamers haven't gotten a good, dedicated LEGO-themed racing game, outside of a cool 2019 Forza Horizon expansion, since the popular LEGO Racers series of the late 90s and early 2000s. However, new reports seem to indicate that the long drought might finally be over. Over the weekend, well, that past weekend, new details and screenshots seemingly leaked out from a closed beta version of LEGO 2K Drive. According to a Reddit post from someone either playing the beta or with knowledge of the test, LEGO 2K Drive is a PvP multiplayer game that is very similar to Mario Kart, and inspired by classic LEGO racing games from the past. The leaker suggests that during races, vehicles automatically transform between on-road, off-road and water forms. Some of the items and power-ups supposedly include mines, homing missiles, brick wheels, and EMPs. Players will be able to create custom cars too. The Reddit post also linked to apparent screenshots of the beta. That does sound very much like Mario Kart. There's not exactly mines, but there's little bombs and homing missiles. Yeah, kind of. EMPs, yes, I think so, if you can consider the lightning flash one. Anyway, carrying on. So those screenshots have since been scrubbed from their original host, but not before someone archived them. They look authentic, showing various in-game menus, logos and different racetracks with themes like a creepy swamp and the Wild West. This lines up nicely with the report from VGC last year that said 2K was partnering up with LEGO for a few different games. One of these was reported to be an open-world racing game developed by Visual Concepts. Last year, a job listing at the studio also mentioned that it was working on an open-world driving game with a major license, which could be LEGO 2K Drive. Kotaku has contacted 2K Games for comment. In addition, Insider Gaming is reporting that it has heard confirmation that a closed beta for LEGO 2K Drive is currently happening. It appears the leaked screenshots came from that beta. The fact that the screenshots were taken down seems to lend even more credence to the fact that 2K didn't want this stuff out there yet. Of course, until LEGO or 2K confirm this game is real and not an elaborate hoax or cancelled project, we can't know for sure. However, says the author, I'd bet a few of my LEGO Star Wars sets that LEGO-based racing is about to return in a major way. Someone reached for comment. 2K pointed Kotaku toward a fresh tweet from the official LEGO account, which hints at a LEGO racing game, and says that a trailer for the unknown game is coming on March the 23rd. Odds are it's LEGO 2K Drive, as the official 2K Twitter account tweeted in reply to LEGO's tease. I don't know if it has yet, but I suppose if you're on Twitter, you can check it. But there you go. I'll just share that there in the chat room for everyone's delectation. Now I'm going to head across to Gizmodo for this next one. And we're in the TARDIS too. We're in the Hooniverse. And you know, before I will start this one, as you heard me at the start of the show, by just feeling somewhat of a disappointment with certain sections of Who fandom who have given this a pretty hard time because they drove themselves nuts because the teaser for this project, people evidently can't read analog clocks anymore. And if I'm offending somebody by saying this, tough. It was pretty evident to me that it said 5 to midnight. So it's a reference to the doomsday clock. So, yeah, it's 5 to midnight. Big hand on the 5, small hand on the 12. 5 to midnight. Okay. And for some reason, people decided, or they chose to see that as saying 11 or saying 11 o'clock, which meant that Matt Smith must be returning. And, of course, various YouTubers who shall remain nameless started sort of speculating wildly. It must be Matt Smith's return. It must be Matt Smith's returning. It's a project to do with Matt Smith, and it's sort of, hold your horses, boys and girls. It's, you don't know yet, do you? And, of course, they then, because they drove themselves into such a frenzy believing it was going to be that, they were indignantly disappointed that it wasn't. Which, of course, is a danger of assuming that, assuming something that isn't actually the case. And the criticism I've seen leveled at this particular project, which I'm going to be talking about, even before you see it, it just makes me so disappointed in certain sections of the Who fandom. It really does. And I think they should all just take a deep breath, step back, and just welcome anything Who related. If you want to criticize something, wait until you've seen it first. If you're not happy with it, then talk about it then. But to criticize something before you've even seen it? Oh, dear. Anyway. Off my soapbox. Yeah, this is authored by James Whitbrook. It was posted up on March the 20th, so a week ago. And Doctor Who's next anniversary project turns Suze Kempner into Doom. So the viral social media star and actress, when she's a trained actress, by the way. She's a classically trained actress, will appear in Doomsday, which is a transmedia event for the show's 60th anniversary celebrations this year. Because, of course, that happens in the 8 months' time. I mean, I can still remember the 10th, the 50th, like it was yesterday. So Doctor Who's 60th anniversary in November 2023 is giving us the series a chance to go seemingly as bonkers as it wants. And why not? Shove David Tennant in as a new Doctor? Sure. Russell T. Davies is back like it's 2008. Hell yeah. TikTok and Twitter superstar Suze Kempner is getting her own series of comics, books, games and media tie-ins. Okay. So this morning, or that morning rather, the BBC announced Doomsday, a new transmedia Doctor Who campaign with Kempner, an award-winning comedian, sketch artist and actor, likely best known worldwide for her viral Twitter and TikTok videos impersonating various political and public figures. In Doomsday, Kempner will play Doom, the titular intergalactic assassin who has found herself hunted by death itself, and must use a purloined vortex manipulator with a day's worth of time-jumping charge to find the Doctor and save herself. So Doomsday is a huge new adventure for the whole Doctor Who universe, starring the brilliant and hilarious Suze Kempner as an intergalactic assassin, returning showrunner Russell T. Davies said in a press release. Her adventures will span comics, audio, a novel, video game stories and more, expanding the world of Doctor Who into brand new territories. Beware the Doomsday, it's coming for us all. So Doomsday will feature multiple familiar Doctor Who faces to celebrate the show's 60th anniversary alongside Kempner, and will play out in a series of stories such as comics from Doctor Who magazine and Titan, audio dramas from Big Finish and BBC Audio, a novel published by Penguin Random House, and a game in development from Eastside Games, each focusing on a different hour of the day Doom has left to save herself. Doctor Who's social media channels will then release a live-action culmination of the event later this year. And yeah, I'm just looking at this. I'm looking at the comments on here, and they're just written to the article, and they're just demonstrating my point. So stop putting mystical stuff into Doctor Who. There is no planet, time, and literal death is not hunting Doom. I'm going to kill 23 people in addition to all the people never before now so I can ask the Doctor to save my life. Sounds like a really mediocre plan. I'm guessing Doom hasn't watched much New Who. Have they watched much Who at all? I mean, good grief. How many people has the Doctor killed? Good grief. Oh dear. Yeah, I mean, seriously, you read the comments on this article, and it's just demonstrating amply what I'm referring to. It's a fictional sci-fi series. It goes wherever it needs to go. Pity's sake. Anyway, I should post this in the chat room. Oh, those people here, the people here at the station know that I'm a pretty dedicated Doctor Who fan. It's just when I see this kind of, thing going on, they're trying something different. It's a show ostensibly about change, and people are griping about change. Anyway, carrying on. The comparisons here there are to Time Lord Victorious, which of course was featuring David Tennant when he became the Time Lord Victorious briefly as the 10th Doctor. They're saying the similarities in the approach of Doomsday to this. I'm gonna just wait and see what happens. I mean, I think it's different, it's exciting, and people should just wait and watch it before they moan. Carrying on. Anyway, back to the articles. Now, the next one, we're heading to the Den of Geek for this one. World of Gaming again. Authored by Aaron Greenbaum. It was posted up on, last Monday as well. And this one I thought was curious. When I saw the headline, I thought, all right. And the headline, of course, is why weren't the real Final Fantasy 2, 3, and 5 released outside of Japan? I thought, well, 2, 3, and 5 were released, weren't they? But I wasn't aware that there was these and there's a real version. What's this about? Let's explore, shall we? So, Final Fantasy 2 and 3 are infamous for not being the true Final Fantasy 2 and 3 in the West, but Square didn't just release the games this way to confuse us. I don't remember Briar saying anything about it. I don't remember him talking about Final Fantasy 2, 3 and 5 very much, to be honest. I mean, Final Fantasy 7, but... anyway, carrying on. And I'll just make sure I've posted that in the chat. I have. Previous article. So these days, Final Fantasy fans are spoiled for choice. Virtually every entry in the mainline series, as well as the spin-offs, are readily available worldwide, both physically and digitally. If you live in North America or Europe and want to play Final Fantasy 1 through 15 in chronological order, you're now able to do just that. However, some gamers remember when this wasn't the case at all. In the early days of Final Fantasy, Square released certain mainline entries exclusively in Japan, which meant the rest of the world had to wait years to get their hands on these games. The situation also meant that Square released certain numerical installments out of order in other regions, which made the franchise even more confusing to follow for players outside Japan. After the success of the original Final Fantasy in North America, Square followed up that title with the even more beloved Final Fantasy II and Final Fantasy III on the SNES. But then the company released Final Fantasy VII on the PlayStation. What happened to the 4th, 5th and 6th entries? North American audiences later learned that what they thought was Final Fantasy II in 1991 was actually Final Fantasy IV in Japan, and that the Final Fantasy III originally released worldwide in 1994 was actually Final Fantasy VI, which raised the obvious question of why? Why didn't Square release Final Fantasy II, III and V in the right order for the rest of the world? A combination of then-emerging technology, localization issues, and concerns over difficulty is to blame. According to an old Game Trailers retrospective, Square Enix originally had every intention of bringing the real Final Fantasy II to North America. Kaoru Moriyama, who ultimately translated Final Fantasy IV, was first charged with the English localization of Final Fantasy II in 1991 and helped produce a functional prototype. Square even had a title for the game's North American version, Final Fantasy II Dark Shadow Over Palakia. But then Square cancelled the localization because it was taking too long and due to the looming release of the SNES. The studio felt Final Fantasy II, which first launched in Japan in 1988, was too old to bring to other regions just as a new, more powerful console was about to hit the market. Instead, Square packaged Japan's Final Fantasy IV, which was the first installment designed for the SNES, which is a Super Nintendo Entertainment System, as Final Fantasy II in North America, to avoid confusing players. Well, I'm confused just reading this, but anyway, carrying on. As the real Final Fantasy III, that game hit store shelves in Japan shortly before the first Final Fantasy even released in North America in 1990. In an interview with Eurogamer, the designer of the first three Final Fantasy games, Hiromichi Tanaka, explained that Square had its hands full with newer installments for the SNES and just didn't have enough developers to work on an English localization of a third installment, even though Nintendo actually advertised one in magazines. In 1994, Square launched its latest game, and arguably its masterpiece, Final Fantasy VI, as Final Fantasy III in North America. This, of course, meant that Japan's Final Fantasy V was also skipped over in the process, not to be released in North America until years after its 1992 launch. Square reportedly tried to ship Final Fantasy V to other regions multiple times, but none of these attempts to localize the game for North America panned out. As the story goes, Square felt the game was too difficult for the average gamer, and that its tone and humor just wouldn't translate in other parts of the world. Square allegedly considered retitling and repackaging the game as a standalone title for other markets in order to distance it from the main series, but the studio ultimately scrapped the idea too. Ted Woolsey, a former translator at Square, claimed one potential name for the game was Final Fantasy Extreme. However, despite all these failures, Square decided that if it couldn't port Final Fantasy V to North American SNES consoles, it would bring the game to PC instead. Square hired the studio Top Dog Software to port the game, but that localization was cancelled. Afterwards, Eidos Interactive purportedly was tasked with porting the game to Windows, but again, no dice. So after all these false starts, gamers decided to channel the phrase, if you want something done right, do it yourself, and made their own fan translation of Final Fantasy V. Before the game was eventually ported to PlayStation in 1999 and Game Boy Advance in 2006, North American audiences could only play Final Fantasy V if they used the fan translation or knew how to read Japanese. Like we said earlier, Final Fantasy fans have it very good in 2023. So let's have a look and see what the comments are. Yeah, I'm not going to read these out loud on air. No. I'm just going to share this one in the chat room. There you go. There we go. I'll just share that. There's somebody with a very unusual name in chat. SDFSG346. I'll take it out. Is that Pi, is it? No, it's not Pi, is it? I'll just say SFDS. I'll just say SDFSG Pi. Be easier. Yeah, I've got time for something else. Let's go back to Kotaku, shall we? Let's see what there is. Well, they've changed one of the headlines during the welcomes to Kotaku Royale, exploring the genre that's defining modern gaming. No, that's not the one I'm looking at. It's this one by Levi Winslow, posted up a couple of hours ago. Netflix star wants to name kids after Elden Ring bosses and the internet approves. So a Love is Blind contestant thinks From Software enemies Godfrey and Godric would be perfectly good baby names. Well, Godfrey was a name. Godfrey and Godric are names, aren't they? Godfrey was a name. Long time ago. It's not frequently used nowadays, but Godfrey was a game. Carrying on. So love makes you do crazy things. When you feel connected to another person, you feel compelled to go to the ends of the earth for them. Maybe you'll take a bullet for your significant other. Maybe you'll do their taxes and handle their dirty laundry, figuratively and literally. Or maybe, as in the case of two contestants in a dating reality show on Netflix, you'll take some inspiration for baby names from developer From Software's mega popular Souls-like Elden Ring. Love knows no bounds. Yes. Excuse me a minute. I'm just going to mute. Oh, it feels like I've got hair down the back of my throat. Ugh. There you go. That's better. So running since February 2020, Netflix's Love is Blind is a dating reality show. Thank God I don't watch it. So something of a social experiment to test the limits of the question, is love really blind? Love is Blind pits a bunch of single people together in the hopes of finding love. Their goal is to get engaged before actually meeting each other in real life. There are speed dating segments, resorts where couples get to know each other on a deeper level, and copious beautiful locales that only the budget of Netflix could afford. While there are three seasons already released in full, it's the currently airing fourth season, and one moment in particular, that has captured the internet's attention, leaving folks confused, laughing, and smitten all at once. In Love is Blind Season 4's fourth episode, Playing with Fire, contestants Irina Solomonova and Zach Gojtowski are newly engaged. They sit on a beach, finally face to face, eating some mouth-watering cheesecake after finishing a scrumptious-looking fish dinner. I'm hungry, leave me alone. Irina, an event-planning business owner, hit it off early in the season with the criminal defense attorney, Zach. After chatting about what cartoon character Zach reminded Irina of and how Irina kind of looked like Megan Fox to Zach, he then broached the baby name conversation, which had briefly surfaced earlier in the season. A bit early to talk about that, isn't it? Anyway, it was at this point that Zach made his gamer tendencies known by talking about Elden Ring bosses. So, before we were talking about names, Zach says. For our kids, Irina asks. Yeah. What about Godfrey, he questions. You, she says, repulsed. Godric, he inquires. No, she chuckles. Like Zion or Gid. Zion? I do like Gideon. I like really unique names. Me too. You know what's a really unique one? Goliath. For the uninitiated or just folks who'd rather not remember getting clapped by them, Godfrey, first Elden Lord and Godric the Grafted, are two of Elden Ring's more challenging boss encounters. While optional, the multi-armed Godric drops a lot of runes, making him a great early game enemy to take down if you want to get a few quick levels. Meanwhile, the Greying Godfrey is a late game boss you must defeat in order to progress the story. Either way, both jerks play pivotal roles as you make your way toward becoming the Elden Lord. Also, whether she knew it or not, Irina mentioned an Elden Ring name as well. the bibliophile Gideon Othnir, an NPC you find hanging out at the roundtable hold. Maybe Arena and Zack were a match made, in the lands between. Since Zack revealed his gamer card to Arena, Twitter has been flooded with all kinds of memes about children named after video game characters. One user always wished they were named after Gears of War's Uzeel Ram, because Ram was a badass. Another imagined their eldest daughter, Lightseeker Hayetta, introducing themselves to their classmates. Someone else thought of the conversation they might have when picking up Astel, natural born of the void, from school. Fourth user joked about naming their kid after the flaming salamander, and the bane of my existence as the author, Magma Worm. That's just the tip of the iceberg here, as there are a plethora of baby name jokes going around. Indeed there are, if you're on Twitter. Yeah, lots of them. I'm not reading them all out. So a first name like Gideon, Godfrey or Godfric does sound pretty badass if a bit fantasy author. However, something like Astel, natural born of the void, certainly doesn't roll off a tongue with any ease, especially when paired with multi-syllable last names such as Gotoyevsky and Solomonova. Still, though, if Arena was looking for unique in terms of names for her children, I don't think you could go wrong with picking from Elden Ring. It's a tad nerdy, sure, but at least it's unlikely their kid would share a name with a classmate. So, there you go. Oh, boy. I thought that Robin Williams named one of his daughters Zelda after the game. After the character. I'm pretty sure they did. I'm pretty sure Robin Williams did name one of his children Zelda. Because he's a big Zelda fan. Anyway, we're coming up to the top of the hour now, folks. So I suggest you go and get yourselves a cup of tea, cup of coffee. And we'll be back after the break with Willow's pep talk segment, which is going to be renamed this time next week. And then we're going to the Poetry Corner, back in time, to study one of the great Chinese poets of all time, Li Bai. And then we're going to be heading, exploring some spooky stuff, slightly, in Spectral Matters. So I'll see you after the break.
Junkie, I won't say a goddamn word. Why? They won't understand. They won't understand why we do it. They won't understand it's about the men next to you. And that's it. That's all it is.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. Number one listener supported radio, the printing press for freedom, at a time when freedom is needed the most.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place in inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Afternoon and welcome back to the second hour of the Monday, the 27th of March, 2023 edition of Willow's World. My name is Willow Andreas, and also known as Sari Sunflower in the Revolution Radio freedomslips.org chat room. Let me get my words out. It's just turned 8 o'clock in the evening over here in the UK, which means it's just turned 3 o'clock in the afternoon over on the East Coast, 2 o'clock in the afternoon Central Time, 1 o'clock in the afternoon Mountain Time. It's just midday over on the West Coast. In Australia, it's between 5 and 7 in the morning. New Zealand, 8 to 9 in the morning. But wherever you are in the world, I hope that life is being reasonably kind to you and that you're not allowing what's unfolding around the world to impact upon you too greatly. Don't let any of it impact you, folks. Don't let any of it unsettle you or phase you in any way, shape or form. don't. Yes, I know. It's scary. It's frightening. You don't know whether that rug is going to be pulled from beneath your feet. I know. But it is essential to ensure that that inner calm, inner peace, inner joy remains intact. And if you feel that any of this, if any of this is unsettling you in any way, shape or form, take a deep breath, step away, center, connect with nature. Do something creative. Dance if you can. Well, I just said that. I have no idea. I can't dance. Not at all, to save my life. But if you want to have a good laugh, watch me. I seriously can't dance. People have attempted to show me how to dance. I can't do it. There you go. That gives you a good laugh for the day. But about two left feet. I haven't got any idea. I think my dance style could best be described as a drunken ant crawling across paper after falling into an inkwell. But anyway, carrying on. Don't let any of it upset you, folks. It's essential at this time to ensure that inner balance remains intact, because it's going to be needed. Because, of course, as I've said before, the idiots that believe they're in charge like to foment chaos because they're better able to handle chaos. Something they can't handle is peace. Remember that. Anyway, folks, we are going to be starting a new selection of poetry today in the Pep Talk segment. And of course, this is the penultimate show where it's going to be known as the Pep Talk segment, because I've never really been happy with it, that title. I've never been happy with it. And I've just eventually settled upon a new moniker for this particular segment, which is going to be debuting next Monday. So whilst this is a new selection of poetry, it's a penultimate time this particular name is going to be used. And yet we're still with Discover Poetry for this particular selection, which is called The Good Old Days. And yeah, there's probably going to be a few crossovers with the previous selection about memories, but there's lots of new ones in there as well. And today's four are The Old Country Store by Ed Blair, The Old Oaken Bucket by Samuel Woodworth, The Family Doctor by Edgar A. Guest, who's been a previous study on the Poetry Corner, and a final one also from Edgar A. Guest is Old Fashioned Letters. So this is the Poetry Corner. You're all settled down, aren't you? You've got your teas and coffees. Good. You've got your dishes of dainty delectables. I've got a couple of throws, because, I mean, even though it's a warmer evening, sometimes there's a little bit of chill in the air. So, yeah, I've got there's one log on the fire. So it's not freezing. It's comfortable. Patchouli today, I thought, for a change. And we'll start with the first of the new selection of poetry, which is The Old Country Store by Ed Blair. Oh, the old country store with the candy jars in it, and the bag of green coffee that sat by the door. The barrel of sorghum with plug driven in it that leaked every hour a few drops on the floor. The barrel of crackers with cover beside it. The cheese where a patron could pilfer a bite. The jugs and the jars with the straw in between them. When I was a boy, 'twas a source of delight. Piled up on the counter, the hickory shirting, a stripe and a plaid for the patrons to choose. Some featherproof ticking, some ducking for breeches, some calicoes, ginghams, a few pairs of shoes. Ginghams actually. Apologies. A barrel of kraut never spoiled in the making. How good it did taste when I tiptoed a wee. And the ginger snap cookies that came in the boxes. What a treat to have one of them given to me. The old country store. What a charm to the youngster. The hogshead of sugar sometimes mixed with sand. And if I was there when the storeman was opening, a lump of its sweetness was placed in my hand. The coffee pots stood in a row on the shelving. The old iron boilers and tubs down below. The can of gunpowder and shot for the hunters. And the waterproof caps that oft-times wouldn't go. Oh, the old country store. What a joy there to visit with post office boxes among cobwebs galore. That gave us the letters and papers on Monday. That rode in the mails for a fortnight or more. Oh, never a city with streetcars and bridges and viaducts, factories. Yeah, all of these can e'er beat the store at the crossroads on Cow Creek, where first I bought candy and crackers and cheese. Next is The Old Oaken Bucket by Samuel Woodworth. How dear to this heart are the scenes of my childhood, when fond recollection presents them to view. The orchard, the meadow, the deep tangled wildwood, and every loved spot which my infancy knew. The wide-spreading pond, and the mill that stood by it, the bridge, and the rock where the cataract fell. The cot of my father, the dairy house nigh it, and e'en the rude bucket that hung in the well. The old oaken bucket, the iron-bound bucket, the moss-covered bucket which hung in the well. That moss-covered vessel I hailed as a treasure, for often at noon when returned from the field, I found it the source of an exquisite pleasure, the purest and sweetest that nature can yield. How ardent I seized it, with hands that were glowing, and quick to the white pebbled bottom it fell. Then soon, with the emblem of truth overflowing, and dripping with coolness, it rose from the well. The old oaken bucket, the iron-bound bucket, the moss-covered bucket arose from the well. How sweet from the green mossy brim to receive it, as poised on the curb it inclined to my lips. Not a full-blushing goblet could tempt me to leave it, the brightest that beauty or revelry sips. And now, far removed from the loved habitation, the tear of regret will intrusively swell, as fancy reverts to my father's plantation, and sighs for the bucket that hangs in the well. The old oaken bucket, the iron-bound bucket, the moss-covered bucket that hangs in the well. Penultimate is The Family Doctor by Edgar A. Guest. I've tried the high-toned specialists who doctor folks today. I've heard the throat man whisper low, come on now, let us spray. I've sat in fancy offices and waited long my turn, and paid for 15 minutes what it took a week to earn. But while these scientific men are kindly, one and all, I miss the good old doctor that my mother used to call. The old-time family doctor. Oh, I'm sorry that he's gone. He ushered us into the world and knew us, every one. He didn't have to ask a lot of questions, for he knew our histories from birth and all the ailments we'd been through. And though as children small we feared the medicines he'd send, the old-time family doctor grew to be our dearest friend. No hour too late, no night too rough for him to heed our call. He knew exactly where to hang his coat up in the hall. He knew exactly where to go, which room upstairs to find the patient he'd been called to see, and saying, never mind, I'll run up there myself and see what's causing all the fuss. It seems we grew to look and lean on him as one of us. He had a big and kindly heart, a fine and tender way. And more than once I've wished that I could call him in today. The specialists are clever men and busy men, I know, and haven't time to doctor as they did long years ago. But someday he may come again, the friend that we can call, the good old family doctor who will love us one and all. Sorry if you can hear a noise there, it's me scratching my head. Finally is Old Fashioned Letters by Edgar A. Guest. Old Fashioned Letters. How good they were. And nobody writes them now. Never at all comes in the scrawl on the written pages which told us all the news of town and the folks we knew, and what they had done or were going to do. It seems we've forgotten how to spend an hour with our pen in hand to write in the language we understand. Old-fashioned letters we used to get and ponder each fond liner. The glad words rolled like running gold, as smoothly their tales of joy they told, and our hearts beat fast with a keen delight as we read the news they were pleased to write and gathered the love they bore. But few of the letters that come today are penned to us in the old-time way. Old-fashioned letters that told us all the tales of the far away, where they'd been and the folks they'd seen. And better than any fine magazine was the writing, too, for it bore the style of a simple heart and a sunny smile, and was pure as the breath of May. Some of them oft were damp with tears, but those were the letters that lived for years. Old-fashioned letters. How good they were. And oh, how we watched the mails. But nobody writes of the quaint delights of the sunny days and the merry nights, or tells us of the things that we yearn to know. That art passed out with the long ago, and lost are the simple tales. Yet we all would happier be, I think, if we'd spend more time with our pen and ink. Thursday show. The four poems will be A Time to Talk by Robert Frost, The Milkman by Christopher Morley, The Furnace also by Christopher Morley, and The Country Schoolhouse by Edwin L. Sabin. But they'll be for Thursday. Now, I've got time for some other bits and pieces. I think I've got time. I've got time for some quotes, I think. Quotes about... That's a strange one. Handwriting. somebody whose handwriting is absolutely abysmal. Yeah, here's some. Just one, because we mentioned handwriting in that poem. I thought, well, yeah, why not? Let's have a look at some quotes about handwriting, shall we? Yeah, there are some. Some good reads. You know the score by now. Author, work if applicable. Then the quote. Christian Dior, a woman's perfume tells more about her than her handwriting. A.A. Milne, who was the study this weekend on the Poetry Corner show. Winnie the Pooh. My spelling is wobbly. It's good spelling, but it wobbles, and the letters get in the wrong places. James Robertson of the Testament of Gideon Mack. I prefer the pen. There is something elemental about the glide and flow of nib and ink on paper. Francine Prose, Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them. Like seeing a photograph of yourself as a child, encountering handwriting that you know was once yours, but that now seems only dimly familiar, can inspire a confrontation with the mystery of time. And I will conclude with George Bernard Shaw from Pygmalion, the beauty and nobility, the august mission and destiny of human handwriting. Actually, I'm going to finish with this one. Vic, I can't spell his name, U by U. Irony, we want our handwriting to look like typed fonts and our computer fonts to look like handwritten text. Yay. That'd be accurate. Yes, indeed. I don't know, just fancied looking at that one. I wasn't sure if there was going to be any. There are, so there you go. Quotes about my handwriting. Don't bother. Anyway, folks, we're going to now, we're all settled in the poetry corner. We're going to now enjoy our study. We're heading back into the world of 8th century Chinese poetry for a study of an individual who was mentioned in the previous study of Du Fu a few months back or so. Li Bai. And I will read the opening paragraphs of his Wikipedia page first, as I always do, before we read his biography from mypoeticside.com. And then I'll be sharing some of his poetry, which obviously won't be read in Japan, in Chinese. These have been translated. So Li Bai was born year 701. He died in the year 762, also pronounced as Li Bo, courtesy name Tai Bai. Was a Chinese poet, claimed from his own time to the present as a brilliant and romantic figure who took traditional poetic forms to new heights. He and his friend Du Fu, who was born in 712 and died in 770, were two of the most prominent figures in the flourishing of Chinese poetry in the Tang Dynasty, which is often called the Golden Age of Chinese Poetry. The expression Three Wonders denotes Li Bai's poetry, Pai Min's swordplay, and Zhang Zhu's calligraphy. Around 1,000 poems attributed to Li are extant. His poems have been collected into the most important Tang Dynasty poetry, Heiyoi Yingling Ji, compiled in 753 by Yin Fan. 34 of Li Bai's poems are included in the anthology 300 Tang Poems, which was first published in the 18th century. Around the same time, translations of his poems began to appear in Europe. The poems were models for celebrating the pleasures of friendship, the depth of nature, solitude, and the joys of drinking wine. Among the most famous are Waking from Drunkenness on a Spring Day, The Hard Road to Shu, and Quiet Night Thought, which are still taught in school books in China. In the West, multilingual translations of Li's poems continue to be made. His life has even taken on a legendary aspect, including tales of drunkenness, chivalry, and the well-known tale that Li drowned when he reached from his boat to grasp the moon's reflection in the river while drunk. Much of Li's life is reflected in his poetry. The poems are about places he visited, friends whom he saw off on journeys to distant locations, perhaps never to meet again, his own dreamlike imaginations embroidered with shamanic overtones, current events of which he had news, descriptions taken from nature in a timeless moment of poetry, and so on. However, of particular importance are the changes in the times through which he lived. His early poetry took place in the context of a golden age of internal peace and prosperity in the Tang Dynasty, under the reign of an emperor who actively promoted and participated in the arts. This ended with the beginning of the rebellion of General An Lan Lushan. His rebellion led most of northern China to be devastated by war and famine. Li's poetry during this period has taken new tones and qualities. Unlike his younger friend Du Fu, Li did not live to see the end of the chaos, However, much of Li's poetry has survived, retaining enduring popularity in mainland China and Taiwan. Li Bai is depicted in the Wu Shuang, the Table of Peerless Heroes by Jin Guliang. So I'll share that there in the chat room for you. And we'll read the biography now from my poetic side. So born in the middle of the Tang Dynasty in 701, Li Po was one of the most prominent, was one of the most prominent writers of his time in China, developing poetic art and producing about 1,000 poems in his lifetime. He and fellow poet Du Fu were responsible for a golden time in Chinese writing, exploring relationships, the natural world, as well as the pleasures of wine, as just mentioned. Li Po was born in Central Asia and moved to Sichuan province when he was 5 years old. He was an avid reader, devouring the popular Confucian works for time, and a skilled swordsman by the time he reached his 20s. He is said to have taken part in many duels in his youth and was considered a master in martial arts. In his mid-20s, he decided to leave Sichuan and become something of a wanderer, getting married at some point, meeting various well-known Chinese personalities, and giving away a good part of his family wealth. Throughout his time travelling, he would write verses and poems about his life, notable for its conversational style and unusual perception of the world around him. In 740, he made his way to Shandong and became part of a group of poets and writers who were primarily concerned with literature and the lavish consumption of wine. In 742, he earned the praise and admiration of the influential Wu Yan, which led to Li Po being summoned to the emperor's palace. A banquet was held for him, and he impressed the local royalty so much, he was asked to take up a position as translator. Whilst a certain amount of mystery surrounds him, he was also fond of drink, and was often under the influence when the emperor visited. Here's an example of some of his poetry. The fields are chill. The sparse rain has stopped. The colours of spring teem on every side. With leaping fish the blue pond is full. With singing thrushes the green boughs droop. The flowers of the field have dabbled their powdered cheeks. The mountain grasses are bent level at the waist. By the bamboo stream the last fragment of cloud blown by the wind slowly scatters away. After offending the politically powerful Gao Lixi, the emperor asked Li Po to leave the royal house. Po went back to wandering for the next 10 years or so, writing many poems during that time. 756 was the period of the An Lushan rebellions, which saw the emperor fleeing to safety. Li Po became advisor to one of the sons of Ming Huang in the royal household, a move that proved to be disastrous when a plan to take power backfired. Po was imprisoned and placed under sentence of death. Fortunately, this was commuted to a life in exile when an old friend and army general, Guo Ziyi, pleaded his case. Though he was supposed to head for the province of Yilan, Po took his time and visited friends, wandering from place to place, enjoying the wine, writing his poetry. Thus it was that Po was nowhere near his place of intended exile when he heard news that he had received a pardon from the imperial office. With the turmoil of the An Lushan rebellions having subsided, Po continued to wander, write and drink, eventually settling in Dangtu. Amongst the flowers, I am alone with my pot of wine, drinking by myself. Then lifting my cup, I asked the moon to drink with me. Its reflection and mine in the wine cup. Just the three of us. Then I sigh, for the moon cannot drink, and my shadow goes emptily along with me, never saying a word. Li Po passed away in 762, and there is some mystery about his death, some saying that he died after being in a boat and trying to reach out to catch a moonbeam. The truth is that Po probably died from natural causes, as a result of his hard drinking lifestyle. Yeah, I'd say that's probably the... the more likely case. Got time to share some of his poems with you. All have been translated, by the way. A mountain revelry. To wash and rinse our souls of their age-old sorrows, we drained 100 jugs of wine. A splendid night it was. In the clear moonlight we were loath to go to bed, but at last drunkenness overtook us, and we laid ourselves down on the empty mountain, the earth for pillow, and the great heaven for coverlet. A vindication. If heaven loved not the wine, a wine star would not be in heaven. If earth loved not the wine spring would not be on the earth. Since heaven and earth love the wine, need a tippling mortal be ashamed? A transparent wine, I hear, has the soothing virtue of a sage, while the turgid is rich, they say, as the fertile mind of the wise. Both the sage and the wise were drinkers. Why seek for peers among gods and goblins? 3 cups open the grand door to bliss. Take a jugful. The universe is yours. Such is the rapture of the wine that the sober shall never inherit. Next is about Tuthu. Or Duthu. I met Tuthu on a mountaintop in August when the sun was hot. Under the shade of his big straw hat, his face was sad. In the years since we last parted, he'd grown wan, exhausted. Poor old Tuthu, I thought then. He must be agonizing over poetry again. Next is Alone and Drinking Under the Moon, which I think I started a little bit earlier on. Amongst the flowers, I am alone with my pot of wine drinking by myself. Then lifting my cup, I ask the moon to drink with me. Its reflection and mine in the wine cup. Just the 3 of us. Then I sigh, for the moon cannot drink, and my shadow goes emptily along with me never saying a word. With no other friends here, I can but use these 2 for company. In the time of happiness, I too must be happy with all around me. I sit and sing, and it is as if the moon accompanies me. And if I dance, it is my shadow that dances along with me. While still not drunk, I am glad to make the moon and my shadow into friends. But then when I have drunk too much, we all part. Yet these are friends I can always count on. These who have no emotion whatsoever. I hope that one day we 3 will meet again, deep in the Milky Way. And Alone Looking at the Mountain is next. Links to all these poems are in the article, by the way. The poetic side link. All the birds have flown up and gone. A lonely cloud floats leisurely by. We never tire of looking at each other. Only the mountain and I. Amidst the flowers, a jug of wine. Yeah, he loved his wine, didn't he? Amidst the flowers, a jug of wine. I pour alone, lacking companionship. So raising the cup, I invite the moon. Then turn to my shadow, which makes 3 of us. Because the moon does not know how to drink, my shadow merely follows the movement of my body. It's very similar, isn't it, to the other one? The moon has brought the shadow to keep me company a while. The practice of mirth should keep pace with spring. I start a song and the moon begins to reel. I rise and dance and the shadow moves grotesquely. While I'm still conscious, let's rejoice with one another. After I'm drunk, let each one go his way. Let us bind ourselves forever for passionless journeyings. Let us swear to meet again, far in the Milky Way. Yeah, I think it's a variation of the earlier one. And I think we'll conclude with... we'll conclude with... Autumn River Song. The moon shimmers in green water. White herons fly through the moonlight. The young man hears a girl gathering water chestnuts. Into the night, singing, they paddle home together. That concludes today's Poetry Corner. I can tell you who Thursday's is going to be already. Mary Darby Robinson. Very interesting character. British poetry. Very interesting character indeed. Indeed, I'll give you a little bit of a spoiler. Apparently, she was considered one of the first great celebrities. It's Mary Darby Robinson. And you'll find out why on Thursday. Anyway, the final 21 minutes of the show, we're going to be exploring the spookier side of life, or kind of, in Spectral Matters. Now, these ones, again, I wasn't sure whether to include them in Spectral Matters. They didn't really sort of... I mean, Spectral Matters is probably more appropriate for them. And these are studies of particular mythological beings. Two very famous and one not so much. But all the articles are from Historic UK's website. All three are aquatic in nature. And the first one, an article authored by Ben Johnson, is about the Kelpie. So we're heading west of the border for this one, or west of this particular border anyway, of England. Not west, north. We're going west a bit later. Excuse my my poor geography there. So Falkirk in Scotland is home to the Kelpies, the largest equine sculpture in the world. Unveiled in April 2014, these 30-metre-high horsehead sculptures are situated in Helix Park near the M9 motorway and are a monument to Scotland's horse-powered industrial heritage. But what are Kelpies? A Kelpie is a shape-changing aquatic spirit of Scottish legend. Its name may derive from the Scottish Gaelic words Kelpich or Colpach, meaning heifer or colt. Kelpies are said to haunt rivers and streams, usually in the shape of a horse. But beware, these are malevolent spirits. The Kelpie may appear as a tame pony beside a river. It is particularly attractive to children, but they should take care, for once on its back, its sticky magical hide will not allow them to dismount. Once trapped in this way, the Kelpie would drag the child into the river, and then it eat him. These water horses can also appear in human form. They may materialize as a beautiful young woman, hoping to lure young men to their death. Or they might take on the form of a hairy human lurking by the river, ready to jump out at unsuspecting travellers and crush them to death in a vice-like grip. Kelpies can also use their magical powers to summon up a flood in order to sweep a traveller away to a watery grave. The sound of a Kelpie's tail entering the water is said to resemble that of thunder. If you are passing by a river and hear an unearthly wailing or howling, take care. It could be a Kelpie warning of an approaching storm. But there is some good news. A Kelpie has a weak spot. Its bridle. Anyone who can get hold of a Kelpie's bridle will have command over it and any other Kelpie. A captive Kelpie is said to have the strength of at least 10 horses and the stamina of many more, and it is highly prized. It is rumoured that the McGregor clan have a Kelpie's bridle, passed down through the generations, and said to have come from an ancestor who took it from a Kelpie near Lochslockert. Lochslockert. I hope I pronounced that correctly. The Kelpie is even mentioned in Robert Burns' poem Addressed to the Dale. When those dissolve the snowy hood and float the jingling icy board, then water Kelpies haunt the ford by your direction, and nighted travellers are allured to their destruction. Not a very good Scottish accent. Apologies for that. A common Scottish folk tale is that of the Kelpie and the 10 children. Having lured 9 children onto its back, it chases after the 10th. A child strokes its nose and his finger becomes stuck fast. He manages to cut off his finger and escapes. The other 9 children are dragged into the water, never to be seen again. There are many similar tales of water horses in mythology. In Orkney there is the Nuggle, in Shetland the Shupilti, and in the Isle of Man, the Capelushti. In Welsh folklore there are the tales of the Ceffyldwr, and in Scotland there is another water horse, the Icwis, I think that's supposed to be, which lurks in lochs and is reputed to be even more vicious than the Kelpie. So next time you are strolling by a pretty river or stream, be vigilant. You may be being watched from the water by a malevolent Kelpie. So there you go. I'll post that in the chat room for you both. The next article, we're staying north of the border. For arguably the most famous of aquatic mythological beings to this day, in an article authored by Ellen Castellow, and it's the on UK, Historic UK again, the history of the Loch Ness Monster. Indeedy. So the Great Glen in the Scottish Highlands is a rift valley 60 miles long and contains 3 famous lochs. Lochy, Oich and Ness. The most famous of these is Loch Ness because of a monster said to lurk in its deep waters. It is deeper than the North Sea and is very long and very, very narrow and has never been known to freeze. There have been numerous sightings of a monster, affectionately known as Nessie. The first recorded account is of an eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation with the Irish saint St. Columba in the 6th century. St. Columba, so the story goes, ordered one of his monks to swim across the loch and fetch a boat. Halfway across, the monster appeared and rushed at the swimmer, roaring in a most frightening way. Columba cried out to the monster, "Go no further, nor touch the man. Go back." The monster is said to have fled. Since then, Nessie has been seen many times but has never harmed anyone. Sightings have been sporadic over the centuries, but in the 20th century Nessie has been more active, which has had a profound effect on local business. 1933 was the year when the first photograph was taken of a monster, or what is said to be the monster. It showed something with a long neck arched over a thick body. The photograph, taken by a London surgeon, caused a sensation when first published in the Daily Mail. The circus owner Bertram Mills, who was travelling via the loch on his way to Inverness, offered a £20,000 reward, which is the equivalent to £2 million today, to anyone who could capture the monster for his circus. But so far, no one has claimed the reward. It could be said that Mills was quite the entrepreneur, since the reward brought many flocking to the loch and both sightings and ticket sales for the nearby circus were on the rise. The fact that the circus animals were fed and watered on the banks of a loch and that the head and neck of the monster closely resembled an elephant's trunk was, perhaps unsurprisingly, not made common knowledge. Yeah, I have to say it does look like an elephant's trunk, yes. In 1951, Lachlan Stewart, a forestry worker who lived beside the loch, also managed to photograph the monster, if that is indeed what it was. He saw three humps in the water appear in line and ran back to his house to get his camera. After taking one photograph, his camera shutter jammed, but his photograph got wide publicity as further proof of the existence of Nessie. Interest in Nessie became intense, and over the years several scientific investigations have taken place. In 1961, the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau was formed, and even two submarines have been brought into the search with sonar experts on board. When the submarine Pisces was diving off Castle Urquhart, where the water is 950 feet deep, a vast underwater cavern was found. Was this Nessie's home? In 1975, four firemen from Hemel Hempstead decided that the monster must be a male, as all monsters usually are, so they built a 309-foot-long papier-mâché lady monster to attract Mr. Nessie. It had false eyelashes, full makeup, and gave out a pre-recorded mating call. Unfortunately, the mating call turned out to be that of a male walrus, so not unsurprisingly, it didn't tempt Nessie. It didn't help either when the lady monster got damaged when set afloat on the water. Her behind was flattened by the jetty when a sudden wind blew her sideways. The attempt was abandoned. However, the Loch Ness monster is not as unique as it seems. Reports of similar creatures have come from other lochs in the West Highlands. Nessie provides us with an enduring mystery, and in the 21st century, where there is an explanation for everything, it is pleasing to think that there are still mysteries like the Loch Ness monster. Indeed, the most recent sighting was in May 2007, when Gordon Holmes, a lab technician, took a video of what he described as this jet black thing about 45 feet long, moving fairly fast in the water. The video was broadcast by BBC Scotland and on STV's North Tonight programme. The credibility of the video has, however, come into question. Amongst other concerns, the video does not include any objects or features by which the size of the thing can be measured. It appears that the existence of Nessie remains to be proved. I thought that the sonar scans actually revealed that there was nothing down there. I thought that they actually had, and I believe because it was landlocked at one time, it's highly plausible that what would be considered normal sea creatures are still in there somewhere. You know, given it was covered with water at one time, the whole thing, and it's now landlocked. That's my theory, but we shall return. We're actually going to be heading back down south now, but west, southwest, over the Welsh border, for a final study of another aquatic mythological being. Article authored by Ben Johnson. And it's the legend of the River Conwy ap Anc. I hope I pronounced that correctly. My Gaelic ain't that good. So it is said that there was a period in time when the good folk who lived along the Conwy Valley were constantly plagued with terrible floods that both drowned their livestock and ruined their crops. The cause of this destruction to people's farms and livelihood was not, however, a natural occurrence. All knew that the floods were caused by the ap Anc. The ap Anc was a legendary Welsh water monster, likened, some have said, to the Loch Ness monster. Ap Anc lived in Llynhir ap Anc, the ap Anc pool in the River Conwy. It was a gigantic beast who, when annoyed, was strong enough to break the banks of the pool, causing the floods. Many attempts had been made to kill him, but it seems that his hide was so tough that no spear, arrow, or any man-made weapon could pierce it. The wise men of the valley held a meeting and decided that if force wouldn't work, then the Ifanc must somehow be enticed out of his pool and removed to a lake far away beyond the mountains, where he could cause no further trouble. The lake chosen to be the Ifanc's new home was Llyn Finon Las, under the dark imposing shadow of Mount Snowdon. Preparations started straight away. The finest blacksmith in the land forged the strong iron chains that would be required to bind and secure the Ifanc, and they sent for Hu Gardan and his two long-horned oxen, the mightiest oxen in Wales, to come to Betsacoed. One minor problem, though. How to coax the Ifanc out of this lake, bind him with chains, and then hitch him to the oxen. It appears that the Ifanc, like many other ugly old monsters, was very partial to beautiful young women, and one maiden in particular, the daughter of a local farmer, was brave enough to volunteer for the quest. The girl approached the Ifanc's lake while her father and the rest of the men remained hidden a short distance away. Standing on the shore, she called softly to him. The waters began to heave and churn, and through it appeared the huge head of the monster. Although tempted to turn and run, the girl bravely stood her ground and, gazing fearlessly into the monster's green-black eyes, began to sing a gentle Welsh lullaby. Slowly the massive great body of the Ifanc crawled out of the lake towards the girl. So sweet was the song that the Ifanc's head slowly sank to the ground in slumber. The girl signalled to her father, and he and the rest of the men emerged from their hiding places and set about binding the Ifanc with the forged iron chains. They'd only just finished their task when the Ifanc awoke, and with a roar of fury at being tricked, the monster slid back into the lake. Fortunately, the chains were long, and a few of the men had been quick enough to hitch them onto the mighty oxen. The oxen braced their muscles and began to pull. Slowly, the Ifanc was dragged out of the water, but it took the strength of Hu Gardan's oxen and every available man to pull him onto the bank. They dragged him up the Leader Valley and then headed northwest toward Finon Las, Lake of the Blue Fountain. On the way up a steep mountain field, one of the oxen was pulling so hard that it lost an eye. It popped out with the strain, and the tears the oxen shed formed Pil-Legad-Irik, Pool of the Ox's Eye. The mighty oxen struggled on until they reached Llyn Finon Las, close to the summit of Snowdon. There the chains of the Ifanc were loosed, and with a roar, the monster leapt straight into the deep blue water that was to become his new home. Encased within the sturdy rock banks of a lake, he remains trapped forever. There we go. And that concludes our exploration of the aquatic mythological beings. I've got time for a little something else, you know. Should we have another look at if I can find it, that is. Where are you? Because I've done so many. The scariest paranormal experiences from doctors. Let's carry this on. If I've got time for a few more of these, I will do. We got up to number 18, didn't we? Yeah, I've got time for... it's not going to let me, is it? No, it's not going to let me do it. So I can't do that one. It's not letting me do it anymore. Anyway, let's see what else I've got then. I've got a minute or two. Um, No, I don't think I will, actually. So what I'll do is I'll tell you what's happening on today's, on the station for the rest of the day. And I can tell you a little bit about what's happening on Thursday's show. So on Studio A, after me, today at 4 p.m. Eastern, will be Mr. Rowe with Crypto Corner. Following Rowe at 5 p.m. will be Deacon John with Liberation Nation. Following Deacon at 6 p.m. will be Crypt Rick with I've Been Thinking. Following Rick at 8 p.m. will be Lorian Fenton with The Fenton Perspective. And rounding off the evening at 10 p.m. Eastern will be Deacon John and the Rabbit with Music Talk. Over on Studio B, the next live show will be at 6 p.m. Eastern. That'll be Mario with This, That and the Other. Following Mario at 8 p.m. will be Scott McKay with The Tipping Point. And rounding off the evening at 10 p.m. Eastern will be Robert Morningstar with The Right Stuff. Over on the Hawk's Nest at 5 p.m. Eastern will be The Open Philosopher with Technocratic Tyranny Blues. And Thursday's show, I can tell you a little bit about that if you want. I'll tell you what's happening. 2 p.m. this coming Thursday, Willow's World. Spiritual matters, first, is going to be the focus in the first hour. We're going to continue looking at crisis apparitions, which, again, is a very interesting topic. And I covered it a couple of weeks ago, but there's yet more that I would like to share. The pep talk segment, the final naming, which is going to become the name of, well, something different. We're going to continue on with the poetry that I started today. And I've already told you what those poems are going to be. The study, of course, is going to be in the poetry corner of Mary Darby Robinson, who, as I mentioned just now, she was one of the first real, she's considered one of the first super celebrities of her day. Very fascinating story behind Mary Robinson. And she had a particularly tragic ending as well. And the Spectral Matters, we're going to be focusing on British myths and legends, history and best haunted sites to visit over here in the UK. So anyway, folks, we come up to the top of the hour now. I'm going to hand you over to Bo. You all take care. Have a lovely 3 days, and I'll see you on Thursday. Take care.
Natural law. Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's I've Been Thinking. Welcome to the Crypt.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Don't miss the Crick, Rick, and Jonathan Show every Saturday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Studio B,